Listener-sponsored community radio since 1960. The time now is 1 p.m. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind coming up.
Hi, everybody. Ben Starr and Kevin O'Donohue here with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to be here. And yes, ideas, concepts, and guests. That's what we like to bring you. Today, we have another guest to bring you, and a guest that you're familiar with if you've been tuning into the program in these last few months. We want to welcome back to the studio Dr. Michael Aaron, the author of Modern Sexuality, Uncovering the Truth About Sex and Relationships. Hello, Michael.
Hey, glad to be here.
It's good to have you back.
Hey, Mike. Good to have you back.
Hey there.
So those of you who tuned in over our last fun drive, we had been offering copies of your book as a premium. And it's always a great time to have you on, simply because the topic of sex is one that is on everybody's mind, right? Whether they want to admit
Literally.
It or not. And it's such a taboo, even though it's such an omnipresent subject. And you're a guy who's devoted years of your life doing this research and giving us a better understanding of sexuality. And that's why it's great to have you back to shed some light on it for us.
Glad to be here. Love to talk about it.
So sex is on the mind of everybody. I mean, I think in your book you say men think about sex 36 times a day.
Yes.
And women about 18 times a day.
That was one of the studies, yeah. So
yeah,
it's on the forefront, no doubt.
But as a sex therapist, sexologist, mm-hmm. You deal... Well, what's the biggest thing you deal with? I mean, break it down for us, because I think it has to do a lot more than with sexuality.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well, I deal with a lot of pretty much the entire spectrum of difficulties. I'd say some of the more common issues that I face are infidelity, this big umbrella topic of desire discordance, which may be lack of sex drive or two individuals wanting different things from sex, whether it's the type of sex or the frequency. I would say those are the two most common ones.
Not wanting it has got to be a big topic.
I mean,
you have a couple come in and, you know, one of them is, you call it desire discrepancy. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, a recent study, there was actually several studies. An older study found that about 15%, 1 in 7 of long-term relationships are sexless, which means they haven't had sex in 6 months or more. And a more recent study found it was 20%. So it affects quite a lot of people. And I think there's some myths about it, that it's always the guy who wants to have sex and you know, and the woman. But, you know, I see quite commonly that it's the woman bringing the guy in. If it's a heterosexual couple, I've worked with all kinds of couples. But it affects everybody.
How do you get it back?
That's a very complex question, because, first of all, you want to think about what is causing this lack of desire.
Yeah.
And it's multi-determined. It could be a number of things. You know, I think the first thing that people typically think is that my partner is no longer attracted to me, but it could be a number of things. You know, one thing that I tell people is that I would say the first session or two, we do a lot of psycho-ed, where I kind of explain folks kind of where I see, you know, how they got to where they're at and what we need to do to reverse course. But what I frequently see is that people, when they first get together, they have this lover role. You know, they take, it's the role of being lovers. That's
right.
They started dating and they were attracted to each other, and they had this sort of, you know, great feeling of being together and wanting to push it forward, and they were lovers. And as they go through life and things happen, their career progresses, they get a mortgage, they buy an apartment, they have kids, whatever goes on, There's these other roles that sprout up and push this lover role to the wayside. And if people aren't very mindful about really preserving and guarding this lover role, it could start in the big scheme of things. If you imagine it like a big circle, it could start to take up a very small piece of that circle and become almost non-existent.
Now, a lot of that lover role has to do with novelty, right? The newness of a relationship, of a situation.
Absolutely. You know, there's this term honeymoon phase.
Sure.
Psychologist in the 70s used this term limerence, right, to mean sort of this 2 year. Her theory was, it was based on evolutionary psychology, that for people to get together and then the child, you know, there's a 9 month pregnancy and then the child is born, and by the time it walks, you're talking about 2 years. So she believed that this sort of honeymoon phase, which she called limerence, lasted 2 years so that there could be a baby born who's now walking, right? That was her theory.
Uh-huh.
But whatever theory you subscribe to, there's no doubt about it that that kind of rush of novelty and excitement of a new person, it's going to fade.
Do you believe monogamy is natural for humans?
Well, that's a challenging question, and I think it's a very good question because historically, our species has not been very monogamous. Now, I think it's not as simple as just saying we are or we're not, because I would like to clarify that a little bit. If you take a look at DNA research, DNA research shows that we've had a kind of society that's been, well, let me give you this statistic, that based on DNA research, a geneticist found that throughout history, 80% of women have reproduced.
And most men have not reproduced.
And 40% of men. So think about it. Mm-hmm. Less than half of men have reproduced, while a majority of women have, which means that a majority of men have reproduced with more than one woman. So we're looking at a kind of polygynous kind of society. There's different kinds of theories that back when we were, you know, at the dawning of civilization, were we more like bonobos, which kind of have more of a kind of where the females are more kind of leading, mm-hmm. or was it more like gorillas, where it's the alpha male dominating everything? We're somewhere in between. Our closest descendant are chimpanzees,
right,
and they're close to more gorillas in the terms of, you have some alpha chimpanzee males that mm-hmm.
that are reproducing with multiple females.
Yeah,
right? Whereas the omega, is that the right word for it?
The alpha, the beta, and omega.
Yeah, right. The omega might be might never reproduce.
Well, then they just have to leave the tribe and find something elsewhere. So, and there's a lot of death, and these tend to be very violent societies because men are fighting for females in these kinds of societies that were in. Chimpanzee societies are very violent.
Right.
But so you could say, okay, the history shows that we have a non-monogamous species here. But I would also say that we've been pair bonding for so long. There's a big difference, okay, between being socially monogamous and being
sexually monogamous.
There's actually a term for this that escapes me. Researchers have looked at animals, and they have found that there's probably a couple hundred animal species that pair bond.
Now, explain that for our listeners, because I think that's a very important term, pair bonding.
Yeah. So they'll take a look at species, and they'll see that the male and the female get together, they have offspring, and they stay together. That's right. Pair bonding.
Uh-huh.
There's thousands of species. They have found that a significant minority, actually a very small minority, I should say, maybe a couple hundred out of thousands, pair bond in that way, where they have a partner and they stay with that partner. But they only found, I believe, 5 or 6 species out of thousands that when they look at DNA, that they were monogamous in a sexual sense, that they only had sex or only reproduced with their pair-bonded partner.
Sure.
So I would say that societally we pair-bond, but we seek non-monogamy in terms of our desires. But I would add a caveat that we also want to look at personality traits. I think there's such things as envy and jealousy, which are heritable. Some people are much more jealous than others. Some people are more open to new experience than others.
Yeah.
So people have various levels of tolerance for monogamy or sorry, for non-monogamy. So I think that in the aggregate, we're more like the species where the couple hundred that socially pair bond, but they're really doing other things. They seek non-monogamy. But I would also add in that people have varying levels of ability to engage in that based on their jealousy levels and how open they are to new experiences.
So as a sex therapist in our modern culture, you must do an assessment of where people are at personality style-wise or characteristic-wise. Because often issues people deal with in sex therapy are, I was raised to think this way. My desire says I want this. And there's a conflict. And how do I resolve this conflict? Is that an often common presentation for you?
It's very common that people's desires are incongruent with social norms. There's a test called the BFI. You can take it online that gives you your score for five personality traits. And the acronym is OCEAN, openness to new experiences, conscientiousness, agreeableness, extroversion, and neuroticism. And sometimes I really do. I like this kind of one-on-one personal thing rather than having people take time. But sometimes I've had people do that and to do it with their partner. And it's quite interesting. We've had some interesting breakthroughs when people take a test, the two partners, and then they compare. And some very interesting discussions have come forth from that.
And helping each other, like if you want more openness, teach me. I mean, I was raised a certain way. I don't like that I'm not open. How can I get more openness?
Well, this is a really great point that you make, because for people to, going back to rekindling desire, where people have to get to is that they have to be able to coach each other and they have to be open to coaching. What happens oftentimes, and I've written about this, where I think any sex therapist has to be a good relationship or couples therapist, because these things are often interconnected. And so you'll find that sexuality issues become global and they seep into communication, or the communication has affected the sexuality and all that. And you'll see people who are very guarded, defensive, and sort of bunkered, hunkered down in their bunkers. And where we need to get to is that people feel like they're allies and they can take coaching rather than being defensive, rather than being antagonistic in the way one says something and then the other person's defensive. We have to change the tone where people experience it as coaching advice and then they're able to receive it.
You mentioned the link between society and communication and our views on sexuality. I want to ask you this. There's been a lot written around the impact of pornography. And with the internet, there's been a massive proliferation of pornography, the availability of it. It's all over the place. Now, some researchers have estimated that the average child in a Western country first sees pornography at 12 years old. So my question for you is, what is your feeling around the effect of pornography on relationships specifically, but also on our sexual culture in general?
Great question as well. And this is a very heated debate in my field, because porn has definitely been a very major cultural force. I would argue that porn has been a technological trailblazer as well. You have VHS tapes and the internet, and all these things were really pushed forward by the internet, you know. And now we're really on the verge of 3D technology. It's going to happen on its own, but porn is pushing it, you know. But back to your question, there is this debate about porn addiction, and does porn change your brain chemistry and so on? I would look at it in this way. I look at it objectively, that porn is, in my mind, a neutral tool. You know, there's alcohol, right, where you could have a few drinks and you enjoyed your night with friends. It's not a big deal. Or you could be drinking day and night. You can't even get to work. It's the tool of, it's the person using it. Now, maybe alcohol isn't the right comparison, because now we're already kind of going in a negative mindset, looking at it, sort of comparing it to alcohol. So that's probably not the best comparison. But my point is that there's pros and cons to anything. Everything is a double-edged sword.
Can it lead to dependence? I mean, that's when you mention alcohol, it can lead to dependence. Yeah. And, you know, it tastes good, it's great, well, it's fine for now, but it's going to lead to a dependence. Well, porn addiction, or is what they call it, porn exposure.
Yeah, let's take a look at the pros and cons, and I'll talk about each. Let's talk about the pros first. So first of all, in my experience, porn has been able to open things up to people, you know, where there's been studies that shown that there was an Irish study that showed that porn didn't have any negative influences on couples that were watching it. They found that people who watch porn tended to have less homophobic and sex negative views.
Uh-huh.
They found that people who watch porn were able to feel less shame about things and were also able to safely explore things about their own sexuality in a private, confidential way without taking risks. So these are all positive things. And in addition, research has showed that sex crimes go down when porn goes up in terms of porn consumption, that theorists believe that
it's an outlet.
It's an outlet. Someone who was going to do something, they go, I mean, there's some very malignant people who are going to do what they want to do regardless, obviously. Mm-hmm. But for some individuals, they satisfy their urges through porn and they go to sleep or whatever. And the research does indicate that.
You're listening to The Positive Mind on 99.5 FM, WBAI. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Aaron, sex therapist, sexologist, sex researcher. And today's topic is rekindling desire. We did get into pornography a bit because I've heard some people say that one way to rekindle desire is to consume pornography with a partner. And I've, you know, of course, as you say, it's a very heated debate. I mean, there are people who say that it objectifies women and that it brings women down. There are people who say that it empowers women. And there are men and women on both sides of that debate.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's an effective tool in rekindling desire?
I think it could be used as an aid. It could be used as a tool for folks to explore. You know, they could sit and watch and thumb through the various feeds and the videos and see what they like, and it can stimulate things. You know, you're talking about the sex wars in feminism. There's pro-sex and anti-sex views. A lot of feminists are sex workers or have been in porn themselves, and they find it to be empowering. And there are other feminists who see it as objectification. But I would say this, that, you know, sexuality encompasses the broad spectrum of human emotions. I would say that in sexuality, you can explore a number of dark themes. I call it the shadow, Jungian shadow.
Yeah.
The entire spectrum of emotions, even dark ones, are part of our humanity. We might feel anger. We might feel like we want to shame, humiliate, or objectify someone. And I would argue that rather than pretend that those things don't exist in humankind, I would say that a much more enlightened approach is to be able to be in touch with them in consensual and safe ways. And I would say that porn may provide that outlet, especially since everyone participating in porn is doing it consensually. You know, they all sign deals and contra, and they sign things. And a lot of there was a study done about female porn performers, and unequivocally, the study found that they found porn to be empowering. They found that their self-esteem went up. They found that their confidence in themselves went up. They have a lot of fans, and they make decent money, which if they're smart mm-hmm. about it, they can mm-hmm. leverage to something else. So I would say this kind of view of this degradation of women, that kind of perspective, is probably inaccurate for the most part.
Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating. You have such a, you know, an opportunity as a sex therapist to cover the gamut, as you say, of human emotions, fears, anxieties, and often with a positive outcome. I mean, if a couple comes in and is not having sex and hasn't had sex for 6 months, and all of a sudden, you know, after 3 months with Michael Aaron, you know, you must have such a great sense of accomplishment.
I do, and it's very tangible. For some folks, this is as concrete as it gets. Some people, this is not about desire, but more sexual dysfunction like ED or whatever. I've helped people to
tell people what ED is.
Erectile dysfunction. Yeah. They had kids, and they sent me pictures of them and their kids later, and they couldn't conceive before. And so that's very tangible.
Oh, wow. That's one I didn't even think of.
That's very tangible.
Yeah. So you gave rise to a child.
I did. I created. I helped create.
I want to be one of you. How do I become a sex therapist?
I'll tell you after the show.
So what is the impact of having children on a sexual relationship? Because we hear a lot about relationships where things are going great. All of a sudden, a baby comes along. Mm-hmm. And it's, as you mentioned at the start of the show, there's this lover role in a relationship that gets pushed to the background by more urgent, pressing needs. Mm-hmm. So now there's a new life to take care of and responsibility. Mm-hmm. What have you seen in terms of your clients and how childbirth, a first child, say, would affect the sex life?
Yeah. Well, it makes things more challenging, especially in the beginning. You know, children typically are more nocturnal, especially the first month, and they have constant needs. And a number of women, it's not really talked about as much, but it should be, have depression, you know, postpartum depression.
Yeah.
And it really should be talked about more. So there's a number of factors why people may feel not sexy and stressed out and so on. I think there's a lot of myths about it, though. Somehow in our society, we got this idea that once you get familiar with your partner and you've been together for a while and all these things happen, that the sex is just inevitably supposed to fall by the wayside. That is not what the research shows. The research shows that the people who have the best sex have been together for a long time and they know each other very well, and they cultivated environment for each of them to have really transcendent experiences with each other when they do have sex. And it doesn't mean that they have sex three or four times a week. It had nothing to do with quantity. It had to do with what they brought to the table. Were they able to be spontaneous and creative with each other? Did they feel transparent and authentic with each other? Did they feel they could surrender to the experience and let go? These are all things that can be harvested. I mean, these are all things that you don't just you know, wake up one day in 10 years and you say, okay, I feel authentic and spontaneous with you. You have to reinforce that.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to.
It's work.
It's, I hope it doesn't feel like work, but it's work in the sense that you're mindful about it and you realize it's a priority. And if you can reinforce it and practice it and kind of mindfully instill it in your relationship through reinforcement, what the studies show is that when people know each other very well, they have the best sex. And it just because they're older and they've gone through life with all kinds of, you know, obstacles like kids and all that, that those may be temporary things. But even with kids, I would argue, you know, everyone has their own circumstances. Maybe they have a nanny, obviously that's expense. Maybe they have grandparent, maybe they have someone in the family who can help. But somehow they have to have a plan about, when we have a child, how do we keep this lover role going? Mm. Because if we don't, sometimes people think if we have a kid, it'll bring us closer together. No. Why would you think that? Seriously, some people think
that. Yeah, it's another job.
No, it doesn't. And it's not going to get better. So sometimes people are afraid of having kids because they're already not having sex.
Right.
So once the kids come, there ain't going to be any sex at all, and they know that. And so they want to get that going and revive that before going and having kids, which I agree with.
So you see this ahead of time. I mean, you must see couples that are getting ready to have a child, and, and you be proactive with them, and you can pretty much predict what can happen and give them the tools. Look, this is, you know, if you're not having sex after you have a child, there's nothing to be ashamed of.
Right.
It's a very common phenomenon. This is, you know, it's a simple course correction. There are ways to get there. I just want to interrupt and say it's so important. I mean, I think you're saying something so important on the air. I mean, people walk around with this myth that I do need to have multiple sex partners. If I don't, I'm, you know, something's not right, or, you know, I'm not going to have good sex in my life. You're really saying something, you know, dramatic here, that the best sex you can have often statistically is with somebody you've been with for 10 years.
Yeah, I would say that's true based on the research. I would also say, as I said before, that no one should feel pressure to do something to fit in with their social group. If other people are doing non-monogamy and it works for them, no one should feel pressure to jump in if they don't. And no one should pressure the monogamous person because they probably have very different personality traits. We have to honor each other's individuality, and everybody, as long as it's consensual, has the right to live their life as they choose.
We want to take callers. I think we have a great topic, reason for people to call in today. We want people that are having great sex and being in relationships for 10 years or more. No, 5 years. Okay. Tell us about, you know, how your sex life is satisfying with a partner you've been with for more than 3 or 4 years.
And I just want to say, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Michael Aaron. He's the author of Modern Sexuality, Uncovering the Truth About Sex and Relationships. Michael's been with us a few times before here on The Positive Mind. Today we're talking about rekindling desire. So if that's something you're going through too, you know, feel free to call about that.
Yeah,
I want to say, Michael, you started the show by letting us know that anywhere from 15 to 20% of couples are sexless, which is defined as not having had sexual contact in the last 6 months. Somewhere out there, I'm sure there are people listening thinking, well, all of this sounds great, you know, be mindful and cultivate this openness, but I don't even know where to begin. You know, it's we've been 6 months or 10 months or a year and a half, and, you know, he doesn't even look at me anymore, or she doesn't, you know, she doesn't touch me anymore.
Right.
There's been this break. What do you say to the person who's feeling almost in a desperate, hopeless situation that doesn't even know how to take the first step to rekindling desire?
Yeah. Wow, that's a, we could spend hours on that one. So let me, before I talk about what my, what I would say or my intervention, let me talk a little bit about kind of how I would view it. What I'm thinking. So I use a number of things, but one thing in particular I find to be very helpful is something called the developmental model of couples therapy, which was developed by two folks in the Bay Area, Ellen Bader and Peter Pearson. And they kind of compared it to some psychoanalytic theory, especially Margaret Mahler, who talked about how the development of a child. I'm not going to get into those specifics, but what I will say, they found that there was a few key stages that people go through, and I tie this into sexuality. So when people first get together, they got this crush, this limerence we talked about, all of these feelings going on. In this model, that's called symbiosis, where they want to merge. They want to be joined at the hip. There's a lot of lying going on, but it's positive lying, you know, sort of like...
I love to go skiing.
Yeah, I told you that one. Yeah, I love everything about Kiwi, I don't know, whatever. Yeah.
Everything you like, I'm going to pretend to like too.
That's right.
And not out of a malicious place, but these lies are made to really reinforce the relationship.
That's right. And where the couple then naturally goes oftentimes is, and this is where things start to fade, this next level, which is called differentiation, where they start to realize differences between each other. You know, this is where the truths come out. I wasn't into skiing in the beginning. Or if they were into something sexually, or they seemed like they liked sex more than they did, or whatever, these things start to, the cracks start to show here, where people start to say, you know what, I'm actually realizing, or I didn't tell you, I'm more like this, and I'm different than you, and we have our differences, and this is differentiation.
Right.
And then what starts to happen, and people may be in different levels. One person may be in symbiosis, where they're hanging on to that dream that we're tied at the hip.
Yes, I'm feeling bad that they don't have that anymore.
Right. While the other one is differentiating.
Right.
And then the next thing would be practicing, where a lot of infidelity happens here, where the person who's practicing just says, I'm going to go off and do my thing. Not only am I different than you, I want to assert my individuality and I'm going to practice it.
And I want to grow.
I want to grow, but I don't feel like I can grow with you.
Exactly.
I'm practicing.
Yeah, sure.
And then if the relationship survives that, there's this rapprochement phase where they come together, and then it's synergistic, where they grow together.
Beautiful.
But when I see people who haven't had sex in a while, I want to know where they're at there. Oftentimes what you'll see is that they struggle with the differentiation process, and maybe right now they're both practicing. In a sense, they're both taking care of their own sexual needs. They're saying, I'm not going to rely on you sexually. I'm into this whatever. It depends on the couple. But I'm not going to get into, you know, the sex bit without really touching the foundation of where are they in developmentally in their relationship.
This is where you earn your money. I mean, I think as a practitioner, I mean, the better you get at diagnostics, the better you get at forecasting where the couple is and where they can get to.
Mm-hmm.
what phase, as you call it, developmentally they're stuck in.
Mm-hmm.
That's where, as a therapist, I think you earn your money, and you become more valuable than another type of therapist. So
we're gonna go ahead and take a short musical break. We're going to come back after this with your phone calls. The number to call, 212-757-5555, with your questions or comments for Dr. Michael Aaron. If you want to talk about great success in a long-term relationship or your lack of success, you have a question or a comment for Dr. Aaron, 212-757-5555. Back after this.
Last night and got that old feeling. When you came inside, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again, I seemed to feel that old yearning. And I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start, for that old feeling is still in my heart. To start, for that old feeling is still in my heart.
Chet Baker here on The Positive Mind, that old feeling, and that's what we're talking about today with Dr. Michael Aaron, how to get that old feeling back. If you're just joining us, we are welcoming back Michael Aaron to The Positive Mind, the author of Modern Sexuality, the Uncovering the Truth About Sex and Relationships. You may have seen him quoted in Men's Health, Women's Health. He's been on CNN, quoted in The Times. He is a well-known expert in the field. We're going to be taking your calls at 212-757-5555. We have Margo on the line. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, my name is Marta.
Marta. Okay, hello. Sorry, missed that.
That's okay. I just have like an insight into this because...
Yeah.
I've been married for 25 years, and we totally lost our spark, completely. We were just going through the motions, and...
What do you want to ask Michael? Because he's right here with us. You put it right to him. Go ahead.
Anyway, I just want to say that I think I figured out how we got it back, okay? So I just wanted to share how we got it back.
Please, that's great.
I had a problem with an addiction to marijuana. I felt like I was losing him. I was losing him in the like fifth year of our marriage. I was like, I'm not feeling spiritually connected. My brain is not with yours. I feel and so therefore I can't commune with you like we used to. Yeah. We also had a child, all that stuff. And he didn't listen. 25 years later, he recently had an affair. It was a quick one. It was horrible. Been through extreme pain in the last, whatever, month. 2 months. But he stopped smoking. He said, I don't want to be, I love you. But I didn't feel desirable. And I was like, either did I.
Great.
It just pulled everything together because I was like, oh, wow, he's actually desirable to someone else. I don't want to lose this, even if it is kind of like a boring situation, although we're not boring because we're artists and we're very exciting people, but it's like I didn't want to lose that, and I almost did, and he almost did, and then we figured it out, stopped the addiction problem. I really feel like I see so many couples with the partner with an addiction problem.
Marta, how long ago did you find out, or how long ago was this infidelity?
It was two months ago.
You know, it's quite often that I see, and I hear you where he stopped his marijuana, right? But you know, I often see it's kind of counterintuitive, but sometimes an affair gives a kind of a reboot or a jump start to people's sex lives. And it's well noted by a number of couples and sex therapists that after an affair, oftentimes people are having much more sex than they've had in a while. And I think there may be a number of reasons why, but for one, it kind of allows you to see the other person as a sexual being again. And there's this kind of sense of competition. I mean, these are kind of very evolutionary primal things, but for whatever reason, for some people, an affair is horrible. It's painful, but it's sort of a reboot that gets people seeing each other again in a sexual way. And they can use it to make the relationship better. And I've seen that happen quite a bit.
It has been, I can't believe it. I mean, I'm in my 50s, I was ready to be in the, 50-year-old woman club of having a really cool apartment, being this cool artist alone. I was ready. And he was like, well, I'm not ready. I don't want to be with a 30-year-old woman and start this life all over again with someone I barely even know. I love you. And so it just has been this incredible reconnecting. And I would hate for anyone to have to go through anything like that, but it did work for us.
Well, Marta, thank you so much for the call, and thank you for tuning in, and we wish you really the best with your marriage and continued rekindling.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right, take care. 212-757-5555 is the number to call. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Aaron, a sex therapist, sexologist, sex researcher, talking about rekindling passion and desire.
What about addiction? I mean, do you often find that there is one element, aside from the infidelity, mm-hmm. but if there's one thing that we can remove from this relationship that would at least improve the communication?
Well, when you're talking about addiction, you could be talking about a number of things. You know, so some people have a physiological dependence to a substance, such as alcohol or marijuana or heroin. Marijuana is questionable, but definitely substances like heroin and cocaine and alcohol, obviously. And, those are all substances which where the person starts to have a relationship with that substance.
Right. So there's three things in the relationship. There's three people.
You're triangulating. You're basically triangulating with this third thing, which is the substance.
Yeah.
I think that in my mind, there's reasons why somebody even becomes addicted in the first place. There's some underlying mental health issues, for example, something that they're trying to escape. A majority of people become addicted because they're trying to self-soothe.
And so do you separate out a person? Let's say, okay, hold it. I found out what the problem is, and they can't process it together. Let me take this person and talk about, or let them share and talk about this issue privately with me.
I do that all the time, especially when I first see a couple. I will divide them. I'll have individual sessions because oftentimes they don't feel comfortable disclosing things with their partner present. And it's all confidential. I let them know. But in order to be able to get to the heart of the issue or what's going on, I often have to separate them so I can talk to them individually.
You know, it's very fascinating what we heard from our last caller about how this affair kind of rekindled the spark and she saw her husband once again as a sexual being. There is this very deep, visceral, biological sense of competition and possessiveness that kicks in.
That's right.
And I mean, I don't think that anyone would recommend an affair as a way to reboot, as you said, but it is fascinating how that worked.
Yeah.
We have another caller on the line. Peter, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you. There's a great emphasis now on our spiritual awakening and sacred sexuality and what we have to learn from very sacred indigenous tribes. And I feel that this community has to evolve to that level because we eventually have to leave the body, and the more we are aware that we are able to transmute and transform the matter through our spirit, the greater our evolution will be.
Do you often, in his book, Modern Sexuality, Michael does talk about the importance or the value of spirituality within the sexual relationship. Do you use it, or have you used it for spiritual purposes? And
well, at the beginning, I did acknowledge tantra yogic practices. But of course, eventually, when you go deeper and deeper in your meditational practice, you do kind of merge into this deep, profound peace. And then eventually, the science of the beyond doesn't become a theoretical aspect. It actually is something that you aspire to, because any other lower desire traps you. It's like a jail of desires.
You
wind up being trapped there, whereas when you really go beyond that and you get glimpses of the science of the beyond, you start experiencing that, and you notice that that is our true opportunity, that we're in this body, which is the roof and crown of all creation, and we have the opportunity to transcend this body consciousness. That is outstanding. That is magnificent.
That is powerful stuff, Peter, and I want to thank you so much for the call. We do want to try to squeeze a few more calls in before the end of the show here today.
Michael, do you have a comment on that? I mean, tantra sex is obviously, those workshops are packed.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's a hot topic. You know, it's kind of the topic of tantra, the way it's taught is, you know, it's kind of an amalgamation of different ideas from ancient Hindu culture. Tantra in the ancient Hindu culture was a little different than here. I will say, though, in terms of research, and Peter talked about spirituality, I will say that there is a huge push of a resurgence of research on psychedelics because of their spiritual qualities. For example, here at NYU, they are doing research on psilocybin, which is the ingredient in magic mushrooms, and they're giving it to, and this is FDA approved, it's in phase 3, so it's going to be legal soon if it continues on, and they're giving it to patients with terminal cancer to help them, to see if it helps them to deal with their mortality. And they experience these spiritual journeys on psilocybin, and when they come out of it and they're tested, they report much less fears of mortality. They feel less depressed. They feel more spiritually connected to the universe, and their mood is significantly uplifted.
So we have a line open at 212-757-5555. It's interesting that you mentioned psilocybin. Terrence McKenna was a friend of Armand DeMille's.
Oh, wonderful.
He had a theory about psilocybin in early humans, early hominids. And his theory was that at low doses, it increases visual acuity, which would in turn make you a better hunter, and therefore, you know, increasing the chances of your offspring survival. But that at medium doses, it increased sexual desire and sexual activity. And so he had this theory of, early man eating these mushrooms off of the ground. It's very fascinating stuff.
Well, early humans their lives were very much interconnected with plants. And in Peru, they still have these, it's part of their religion, where they take ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic, it's a plant, And it's legal in America. They have these ceremonies because it's protected by religious, you know, laws, freedom of religion. And this is just an example of how humanity has always had this deep connection to plants, and they've used it with sexuality often for spiritual experiences.
Fantastic.
Let's take another call. We have
Biana.
Biana on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
This is such a vast and ubiquitous discussion, because how do you link all this intimacy with the infinity of life, you know? It's amazing stuff.
Yeah. Isn't it great?
Yeah, because everything is tiny and yet it's vast. But anyway, you know, I would say, like, I mean, just to make maybe perhaps some kind of contribution. I mean, I feel that in my relationship, which I feel is really, really good, we've been like 12 years now, but it sort of goes like the ocean tides, you know. Sometimes you communicate a lot, and then some days you don't speak that much, but I just let the natural ebb and flow take hold, you know, sometimes. But also, in our relationship, like, we're both very, very, very healthy. Like, we're raised that way. Like, we're both athletes.
Uh-huh.
And we find that the healthier we are, the more, you know, we need to be healthy. And we just find that, I mean, it's what I've learned in my life, and what he seems to also embrace, is like, when you're really, really healthy, it's like this whole new science that all health begins in the gut. And, like, when we're both really skinny and really muscular and really healthy, everything just takes shape. You don't ever think about it. We don't communicate about our relationship. We don't talk about it.
You don't need to.
You don't, we just go with it, and I just trust. You know what I feel? The main thing for intimacy and relationship is trust. When that other person knows that you don't question them, you just trust them.
Yeah.
They always feel comfortable to come back. But if you say, where were you? Now, he does it to me because I can take it. He'll be like, well, where were you? It's 8 o'clock. Where
he wants you around all the
and
time.
And I'm like, I just laugh because that means that he cares about me. Biana, I don't get mad.
Biana, we're going to take you off and let Michael comment, you know? Because you say a lot of nice things. So thank you for the call.
But it's too nice?
Yes. More than nice.
Okay,
keep calling us. So I like that about her relationship as a wave, you know, that comes in and out, and that she's in sync. You know, in some couples, they don't need to talk a lot. They don't, you know, they don't need these mundane conversations, updates, and whatever.
Well, you know, I think she's speaking also to, when she talked about trust, she's talking about vulnerability. She trusts that her partner isn't going to attack her, criticize her, judge her. That's what I heard, sort of between the lines. And That's what a healthy relationship is about, where you're not the opposite would be that you're walking on eggshells all the time.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think trust is so important, so vital to any relationship. I mean, not just a romantic or sexual relationship, but, you know, even a friendship or mm-hmm. a working relationship, a business relationship.
Well, look at our society right now. It's quite divided.
And how much do you trust your current partner? There's a good question. I mean, do you ever use that question? And, I mean, that can be a real confrontation.
I have. I'll typically ask that in breakout individual sessions, like I said.
Okay.
I want to get a lay of the land and be prepped and understand where they're coming from.
There comes a time when that question doesn't have to be confrontational.
But I'll tell you how I phrase it, which I find to be even more productive and helpful.
Yeah.
I'll ask the other partner, do you think that your partner trusts you? Mm. Rather than do you...
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Wonderful.
What do you... I want to find out if they have a accurate, or what is their theory of mind of their partner.
Mm.
Do they understand what the partner's thinking? Do they understand what their partner's feeling? What do they imagine their partner's thinking? Because if it's miles apart from what their partner's really thinking, we got a dialogue there. We got to bridge that gap.
Yep.
We have time for about one more call. Let's talk with Quincy. Thanks for calling, Quincy.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
How are you?
Good. I just got a question, sort of. You know, you guys were talking about intimacy and, you know, how there's plants and stuff that could sort of increase that. do you think like video games and pornography and these kinds of things could, you know, sort of be making men feel like they're Genghis Khan and much less interested in the lover role?
Important question.
Well, you'll see a lot of articles about kind of men dropping out. There's a whole movement. I don't know if it's big, but it's called MGTOW, men going their own way. And you'll hear about that, kind of like men, especially younger men, are doing worse than women in the sense that they're much less likely to graduate high school. They're much less likely to go to college and have college degrees. And men are struggling right now. And I would say, look, anything, all this research, no research has shown that video games create more violence or that porn creates sexual deviancy of any kind. In fact, the opposite, as I mentioned, when there's more porn in society, sex crimes go down. I think if people isolate themselves with these things, porn or video games, like they really are isolating, I think there's other mental health issues going on, and that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg. And what I'd be interested in is focusing less on, okay, what kind of porn did you watch or what video game, and what I want to understand what is making this person feel like they're the best way
absolutely
to soothe.
I mean, I sort of think the same thing. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
but
worries.
You know, the increase in, you know, the feminist rhetoric right now, I think, is kind of also sort of playing a part to this, where, you know, it's men are already not really doing very well, and then you have, you know, like the march, where they're not talking about things that really affect men too. And so I kind of feel like that's sort of helping to isolate men, and then they have this alternative where I was saying they get to feel like Genghis Khan versus the reality where, you know, they're kind of oppressed.
What do you mean by feeling like Genghis Khan?
I mean that, well, in a video game, for example, it makes people feel, you know, like they're accomplishing something, like they're doing great things,
fantasy world, right.
In a fantasy world. And likewise, with pornography, it's like you can pick all sorts of different links for, like, this kind of sex or this kind of sex or this kind of person or that kind of person. It's like there's so much variety. And then when you have a relationship where there's real consequences for certain things and they're already in a hole, and then there's all this rhetoric about how men are, you know, abusive or, you know, they're bad or, like, you know, they shouldn't be objectifying women and all these kinds of things. It's making them sort of less interested.
Quincy, this is a book for you. This is one for you.
Yeah.
Modern Sexuality, Uncovering the Truth About Sex and Relationships with Dr. Michael Aaron. You bring up a lot of really very good points. We could go in so many different directions with what you're saying. Keep calling us. We like a call like this. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Quincy. We are right up against the break. So
I did want to say one last thing, Ben.
What's
because
that?
The gentleman who brought up about Tantra, you know, in Michael's book, he talks about, you know, there are 236 reasons people have sex, but
according to the study.
But you know, I thought it was important that, you know, as a society and as a humanity, we're evolving to the point where sex is not simply about procreation.
Sure.
You know, and we were raised maybe thinking, I know that I was, that subconsciously, unconsciously, that sexuality has to lead to a family, a child. And we're slowly getting away from that. And so now sexuality can fill so many different functions. Just briefly, we have about a minute. Can you tell us, I know fun is one of them.
Yeah.
Connection is another one.
Yeah.
Trauma, you can work out your trauma
right.
if you have a real compassionate partner. And
you
want to develop more compassion, bring your trauma issues to your partner. Say more about this.
Yeah, there's a number of reasons why people have sex that have little necessarily to do with wanting a long-term partner or having children. Let me just make a quick statement that evolutionary psychology has long thought that we enjoy sex because of its procreative aspects, but that's not the current thinking. The current thinking is that it, you know, when we were all tribes, that there's a lot of theories that a lot of the women in the tribe would have sex with many of the men in the tribe, so that none of the men would know which was the father.
Oh, yeah, so they'd all have to take care of the baby.
Right. So
offspring.
That's an example how sex is about bonding the tribe. It's about connection and bonding.
Yeah.
You know, we have all of these hormones that are released, you know, the oxytocin, sure. vasopressin in men, those are released as bonding hormones when we have a sexual connection. So I think the predominant idea now in those academic circles is that sex, the number one function is not procreation, it's about connection. And even in today's society, there's a big study that just came out. They're going to write an article about it in USA Today. But the study showed that I think 35 or 40% of people have stated that they've had sex with somebody before a first date to test whether or not they wanted to even start dating that person.
Oh, man, now you're bringing up Woody Allen. Wow. Why don't we go home right now before we go on the date? Yeah. See if we like each other.
Ladies and gentlemen, anyway. Dr. Michael Aaron, thanks for being with us again here on The Positive Mind. His book is Modern Sexuality, Uncovering the Truth About Sex and Relationships. You can find him on Twitter at Michael Aaron, PhD. And you can find us here every Tuesday and Wednesday on WBAI at 1 p.m. We are here on West 57th Street, taking your emails at positivemind@wbai.org. And, of course, you can find us on iTunes on the WBAI website. Again, our email is positivemind@wbai.org. Feel free to give us a call anytime, 212-757-4488. And become a BAI buddy. Go on wbai.org and click on Ways to Donate. And become a BAI buddy. Help us reduce our future frequency and length of fund drives.
We'll be having Michael back.
Michael's a great guest. We'll definitely have you back, Michael. Thanks for being here. And thanks to everyone for listening and calling in. We'll be back Tuesday at 1 p.m. Take care.
I just